my name is Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, and we are here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. This is my new apartment. I've been here about 4 months. I moved from San Francisco, where I was living the last 10 years. And my work in broad terms, you know, I'm a writer, an activist, an editor, a social critic, a bit of a troublemaker, a contrarian, perhaps. And a lot of my work is about challenging the violence of the assimilationist sort of gay movement.
When and where were you born?
I was born in Washington, D.C., you know, one of the most horrible places in the world, without a question. And I grew up in the suburbs in a sort of like assimilated Jewish professional family, where sort of the violence of my parents, you know, I was sexually abused by my parents, and their violence was allowed to remain hidden by their success. And so, in a lot of ways, I learned a lot from that, you know, about how systemic violence is camouflaged through sort of, you know, class, educational, scholarly attainment. I went to, you know, like a private high school. I was kind of like an overachiever high school student. And then I left and went, you know, to fancy, like, you know, East Coast, you know, liberal arts college, and thought like, oh, finally, I've gotten away. And then when I got there, I realized, oh, I'm not really getting away. I'm just learning how to become my parents, you know, and actually to beat them. But I was beating them on their terms, you know, by going to a better college than them, doing better in school, being more of a sort of like intellectual, being more challenging and critical, but it was still on their terms. And so I decided I needed to leave. And so I left after a year and I moved to San Francisco. And that was 1991 in San Francisco. Oh, no, sorry. 1992 in San Francisco. And that's pretty much where I sort of, you know, learned my politics in a way, and not in the conventional way, but sort of like from radical outsider, you know, queers, you know, and from people kind of, a lot of like abuse survivors, a lot of people like running away, a lot of activists, drug addicts, whores, you know, strippers, anarchists, vegans, you know, it was the whole like motley crew, you know, and we were all kind of a mess, but we're trying to like figure ourselves out. And also that's when I became involved with ACT UP. So in 1992 in San Francisco.
Let me go back for a minute to when you're growing up as a teenager. How did you come to terms with your sexual orientation and gender identity, and what were you thinking about at the moment? How would you have identified yourself? That's part A. And part B would be, how was it to be gender, sexually diverse in that context?
Well, growing up, like, I was called a faggot, you know, starting around, I mean, as long as I can remember, like 4, 3, you know, at school, like the kids would like taunt me on the playground, sissy, you know. And I actually didn't really, I didn't even know what that was, you know, I just knew it was something horrible, you know, and it was something that I didn't want to be. And I knew that it set me apart from everyone else. And there were other things that set me apart too, but that was like the one that people hated the most, I think. I think people also hated, you know, just like me for being kind of like thoughtful or like critical or, you know, smart or whatever. But I think the thing I would always get taunted, you know, from as long as I can remember. And I think around fourth grade, I think, you know, somewhere in the early grade, second, third, fourth grade, I realized what a faggot was. Because I've been called it all my life. And I was like, oh, well. And I was like, oh, yeah, that is what I am. But how do they know? You know, and I didn't really understand that, of course, what they were seeing was mostly gender, not sexuality. But the two are the same in terms of people's prejudices. And so they were seeing, you know, that I was this queenie little boy, you know, and I liked to trade stickers with the girls at recess. I didn't like to play sports, you know. If we played Greek dodge, I would only dodge, you know. And I liked the teachers better than the students. The kids were just scary to me, and like I would much rather talk to a teacher. So that's when I knew. But I also definitely internalized the entire message that, you know, this was like a horrible thing, you know. And I also, I knew that if I ever said I was a faggot, then I would never be anything else, you know, to like my parents or to the teachers or to, and I was still kind of, I was definitely in my parents' mold of like wanting to like hyper attainment, you know, so to be like really successful in school and really to beat them, you know, like that was a lot of it. It was like beating my father in particular.
You say that you internalize it as a horrible thing. It meant that you were repressing your identity?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I was, yeah, I would say, yeah. I mean, but more than that, I would say it was that I didn't want anyone to know. Like, I don't know that I had a way of repressing my identity. I mean, I would, yeah, I think I would try to do things like, you know, I would watch how people, how, like, guys walked, you know, and I would, like, try to walk like them or something. You know, I would, I think, yeah, I would sort of, like, capture kind of, like, poses, you know, like, have a kind of, like, distance or a, you know, hands in your pockets, you know, a kind of, like I would practice those kinds of things. But it never worked, you know, in terms of, like, no one ever thought I was anything else than a faggot. Around 14, I started having sex with men in public bathrooms. And that was, like, mostly at, like, department stores. So, like, department stores and libraries and public spaces in D.C. And but I still, I mean, I would go to bathrooms, like, almost every day, like, after school. And it was kind of like a compulsion, but it was still, it wasn't fun. I mean, nothing was fun about it. It was just, like, something I needed. And I, every time I would say, I'm never going there again. And I think part of it, actually, I would never have known this then. Well, what I did know then was that I kind of didn't want to feel it, you know. I didn't want to feel anything, actually. Like, I just wanted to be in my head, you know. And I didn't, because it felt safer. It's, like, safe. It felt safer in my head, you know. I could have some control. And so I would go to the bathrooms and, like, try not to feel what was happening, you know. And I also didn't have any way of, I didn't know how to say, like, I didn't want, you know, if I wasn't attracted to someone. It was just, like, a person. And they were all, you know, mostly older men. And all my, I mean, they were all older than me. but most of them were probably, like, you know, 50s, 60s, you know. There were definitely people in their 30s, too, but that was still, like, 20 years older than me, you know. I guess what I discovered, I was like, oh, this is a secret world. Like, that's how I saw it. It's a secret world where the gestures that everyone knows, that no one knows is going on, is how it felt to me, you know. And I think there was, after going there for a while, then maybe a few years, like I was sort of more able to sort of inhabit my desire more than just trying to escape it, you know. And so, like, I would lead people into, like, stairwells. I mean, I learned there are all these, like, hidden rules, you know, like, you know, you, like, slide a pen underneath the stall, you know, wrapped in a piece of toilet paper, and it said, meet me in the stairwell, or let's go to the third floor bathroom, or, but I kind of had some adventures, I guess, in a way, and weird conversations.
Did you establish any affective relationships with any of these people?
No, never.
You met someone that you made friends with, or?
No. I mean, I think there were a few people who maybe wanted that, and I remember this one guy, he drove me to my father's office, which is where I would go after school to get a ride home. And he gave me his card, and of course he was a lobbyist. so there were people that maybe reached out a little like that, but, and I mean, that's pretty dangerous, you know, for someone like that to give a 15-year-old his card.
At what point do you understand that this life that you are constructing for yourself actually has a history and a background? And when do you start to think of yourself more in political terms and to construct a kind of political articulation of your desire and pleasure and so on?
At a certain point, probably around the same time, like the beginning of high school, like I realized, oh, first of all, I'm never going to belong. And second of all, I don't think I want to belong with these people, you know, who are enacting this kind of like violence over and over, whether it's a violence of social exclusion, the violence of, you know, compulsory masculinity, the violence of, you know, class attainment, you know, all these things. I realized, oh, I don't want to be part of that. And I also realized that I didn't respect my parents on any term and that I never wanted to have a relationship with them, you know. And I did, of course, have a relationship with them because I was still living with them and I was dependent on them, but I didn't want any threat. The other thing I realized was that, because I was always in school, I was really scared. you know, and I was really introverted. And I really only wanted to talk to the teachers. I would like be like this all the time, you know. I mean, I would always raise my hand, you know, but I was scared, and I knew that everyone knew it. And I realized, well, I'm never going to find the people that I want to meet unless I can show something other than fear. And so I made a very conscious decision to like project a more extroverted, you know, it was kind of a facade in a way, but it was also something that I developed, you know, and also a sense of invulnerability rather than vulnerability. I wanted, so, you know, like if someone called me a faggot, I could just smile and be like, okay, you know, or maybe I think the thing that everyone said then would be like, well, everyone's bisexual, you know? And so, but mostly I sort of, the identity I had then was freak. That was what I was cultivating. So I wanted, and I also would encourage people to not care about what other people thought. So my friends, I would encourage them to talk back to their parents, talk back to teachers, tell people they didn't like them, you know. And I sort of became, like, people would look at me like that, you know. Even if I was still scared inside, like, I had this, I cultivated that kind of sense of self. And then it ended up going deeper. I mean, it started, I think, more surface, but it ended up actually sort of becoming who I was. But I still didn't want anyone to know I was a fag.
When did you come out?
I think when I left high school, I went to college, and I was kind of like, I don't know that I came out. It was kind of just like, oh, well, of course I'm queer. It was just a very, because it was a different environment and there were people who were queer. And that was probably the first identity. It was queer, specifically. I never did gay. You know, it was like, because I was already a freak and I wanted to be an outsider. And I was already, you know, politicized, especially about environmentalism and gender, or misogyny in particular, and racism. And I think this was the first Gulf War. So it was very, like, anti-war. That was, like, my high school graduation was when President Bush started bombing, you know.
How do you identify yourself now?
I would identify in similar terms. As a queer, as a faggot, as a queen, genderqueer. I would say, like, if I wanted to have, like, one little statement, it would be a genderqueer faggot and a queen. Like, on the trans continuum in a sort of, like, gender bending, gender blur kind of place. But, I mean, the words that I relate to the most are probably faggot and queen. Queer would be more the political, broader identity.
Can you describe to me the queer scene that you find in the early 1990s when mm-hmm. you start to work politically? Your experience with ACT UP, because I think it's a very different time at the moment that we're mm-hmm. living. And perhaps if you can trace that progression from still leaving this sense of urgency of ACT UP as a social movement to this process of normalization of the LGBT agenda that mm-hmm. we're living today.
I think what I discovered in San Francisco was, I mean, there was kind of like this bustling culture of radical identified queers really wanting to like live on the margins. So consciously choosing to not have like sort of mainstream identity, whether that meant educational attainment, whether that meant, you know, gay consumerism, or whether that meant, you know, the conventional kinds of status, you know, people were trying to challenge. When I went to San Francisco, I knew I wanted to go to ACT UP, you know, and what I found at ACT UP, of course, was the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And the point of ACT UP, you know, was to sort of challenge the violence of mostly government inaction that was enabling people to die of AIDS. And ACT UP San Francisco, each ACT UP, I mean, you know, in the U.S. at that time, I think there were probably about 50 ACT UPs, and around the world, probably another dozen or more. Probably a couple dozen, actually. And ACT UP, but each one had a different focus. And ACT UP San Francisco at that time, which had recently split, and there were two ACT UPs in San Francisco. And one of them was ACT UP Golden Gate, which was very focused on treatment activism. And that meant, you know, getting drugs into bodies, basically. But not much else. And ACT UP San Francisco was focused on several different areas. One was universal healthcare, one was needle exchange, one was prisoners with HIV and AIDS, and the other was women with HIV. And so there was a really integrated politic where people said, well, you can't, you know, fight AIDS without fighting misogyny and racism and classism and homophobia. You know, it was all tied together. And in ACT UP at that time, you know, I met all these, a lot of people who had been activists for generations. So including people who had, you know, they never acknowledged exactly what they had done, but, you know, people who in the 70s were militant, you know, radical activists who probably, like, bombed buildings, and some of whom got arrested and were still in prison, you know. And then also people who had recently graduated college. But everyone had a very radical and very feminist politic, actually, in that particular ACT UP. And there was this sense, I think, just in, even in gay, even in, like, mainstream gay culture, there was this sense that everyone around you was dying, because they were. And especially in San Francisco, you know, this is before protease inhibitors and before there were really any drugs that worked. I mean, the drugs, you know, someone might get healthy for a few weeks or a few months, or, and then they were dead. And, you know, you would meet people, like, I remember meeting this one person who, you know, I had sex with, and he lit candles and was very romantic. And I knew he was positive, you know. And then, like, 6 weeks later, he was dead. I mean, at that point, he just seemed totally fine, you know, like, healthy. Or, like, someone who came to look at it, the apartment where I was living, wanted to be a roommate and was a little wacky, like, you know, this queen who wanted to do, like, touch healing on everyone. And we're like, okay, anyway, I don't think you're moving in with us. But, you know, she was a sweetheart. And then, you know, a few years later, she's dead, you know. And especially in ACT UP, of course, there were a lot of people who were positive and a lot of people with AIDS. And so it was kind of a given that you were going to meet people who were going to die. You know, and they would make that very clear, you know, I mean, because it was, that was part of ACT UP, was, you know, that there's no shame around being HIV positive, you know, and the shame was on the government, you know, the shame was on politicians, the shame was on the church, you know, the shame was on, like, the demagogues around the world who were facilitating the mass murder, really, of, you know, people with HIV and AIDS. In San Francisco, in broader terms, in, like, queer San Francisco, which at that point was very centered in, like, the Mission, you know, a sort of neighborhood in San Francisco. And, like, I think it always felt like people were dying, and it wasn't necessarily, it was AIDS, but it was also drug addiction, and it was also suicide. And all three of them were just very prevalent, you know. And it kind of just seemed like that's what happened, is you died young. A lot of the people who became, like, my sort of queer heroes, or at least people who I respected, like, I found out about in their obituaries, you know. Like, David Wojnarowicz, for example, you know. That's how I read an obituary, and then I was like, oh, this person sounds great. Or even, like, you would go to a movie, like a Derek Jarman movie or something, and then a few years later, he was dead, you know. And I think, I mean, especially in, you know, terms of people to look up to who were fags, you know, it was kind of, And fags living on the margins, it was kind of just kind of considered like, oh, they're dying, you know, we're dying, you know. And so there was that urgency around, you know, needing to engage in direct action immediately to change the status quo. There were a bunch of different activist groups at that time in San Francisco, and we all kind of worked together. So especially there was BayCor, which is the radical abortion rights group. And there was WAC, the Women's Action Coalition. Queer Nation was just ending, and there was RAW, which was Roots Against War. And so the four, RAW, BayCor, ACT UP, and WAC, we would do these coalition actions together. And at one point, there was this other group that started that was some people who were involved in RAW, which was all people of color, and then people they invited in to join them. And it was a group to challenge the scapegoating of homelessness in San Francisco. And this was at a time, it was called the Matrix Program, which was kind of a precursor to Giuliani's quality of life. So Giuliani learned a lot from the Matrix Program, I think. And so it was Mayor Frank Jordan, and the whole idea was to just, you know, get rid of homeless people. So whatever you can do, like, you can put them in jail, you can ship them out of San Francisco, shut off certain neighborhoods, private security forces, the whole thing. And so the first thing we did is we had a sleep out on the mayor's steps, and then we all got arrested. And then we were creating this new direct action group, because we got a lot of attention. And then in that group, we had to decide whether we were operating by consensus or a Democratic majority. And ACT UP in San Francisco was a consensus group. And I thought it worked, you know, really well. And so I was very much in favor of consensus. And most of the other really vocal people in the group were entirely against consensus. And so people would get up and they would just scream. I mean, just like rip me to shreds, you know. And I would sit there like super calm, you know, and be like, oh, well, you know, the reason I don't exactly agree with what you're saying is blah, 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 blah. And I always thought when this would happen in groups, because it happened in ACT UP too, but not in quite this way. But I always thought, well, people aren't really angry at me. You know, they're angry about the issues. They're angry because people are dying. And I can take that. You know, I can take their anger. But I think what I realized is that I would just take it all and put it in my body. And that was the same thing I did with my father. You know, and this was the same time when I didn't remember that I was sexually abused as it was happening. I like blocked it out. So this is when I remembered, and that, so I was actively like thinking, and it sort of challenged everything about how I saw myself, you know, and so I thought, well, I can't do that kind. If I'm going to do that, then I'm just furthering the same thing. I'm never going to heal. You know, I'm just taking other people's anger and I'm putting it in my body, and I feel like a mess. And so that's been a lifelong process now, you know, of trying to not have that in my body, you know. And it made me think about direct action in a different way too. Like it made me think, well, how can I do direct action in a way that where, you know, at meetings, for example, everyone isn't just ripping each other to shreds. And then thinking, well, it's okay because we're talking about the issues.
Let's go back to the trajectory from the state of this queer activist movement that you live in San Francisco mm-hmm. in the early 90s to how it's been progressing into this politics of assimilation, which seems to be a word that you're very fond of.
In 1993, there was like a big march on Washington, you know, like, I think it was called the March on Washington for Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Rights. That was the language then. And a bunch of us went from ACT UP, from different ACT UPs all over the country, in order to have like a national organized civil disobedience for universal health care. And it was sort of modeled after some of the big ACT UP actions that were in the late 80s. But of course, this is 1993, so a very different political climate. And as, you know, ACT UP in the late 80s to the early 90s was kind of big. You know, like if you went to an ACT UP New York meeting, there might be like 300 people there. San Francisco might have had like, you know, 100 or more. And by the time I got involved in ACT UP, there would never be more than like 30 or 40 people, maybe. Yeah, about that. But there's a very different, I think people were like, kind of like, it wasn't trendy, you know, like I think in the late 80s, especially late 80s, I think it was kind of trendy. And so you'd say you were an ACT UP and people were like, oh, anyway, let me like, I was an ACT UP in 89. And it's like, well, you know, people are still dying and nothing has changed. So maybe it should be an app. But, so there was that, there was definitely that apathy was kind of coming on. And I think, but there were these big actions, you know, like the FDA action, these big actions in ACT UP, which drew like, you know, over 1,000 people and like hundreds and hundreds of people would get arrested. And so this is sort of trying to be one of those actions. And so we thought we'd have hundreds of people coming from all over the country to get arrested for universal health care. And I can't remember if it was 41 or 141, but it was definitely not more than that, you know. And what we did, you know, we went to the Capitol. And it's very easy to get arrested at the Capitol. You just step over the line. And then they're like, okay, jail. So, but the march as a whole, you know, and there were actually a bunch of ACT UP actions, like the whole week, there was a different ACT UP action. But that was the big one that was supposed to be the culmination. And it was actually very kind of small, you know, and of course didn't get very much media attention and did not mobilize. And whereas, I'm sorry, there were a million people came to this march, you know, so there were a million like gay and lesbian people coming from all over the country. And, but the march as a whole, and also it was in DC, which is where I grew up. And so the march as a whole was, you know, like so assimilationist in terms of, in so many different ways. One was just in terms of how it looked, you know, it was like white gay men in white t-shirts, like partying basically, you know, and then of course there were other people, but that was the central like sort of imagery. And the big issue at that moment was gays in the military. And this was, this was really the emergence of that as the national gay issue. And I think it was so telling to me, like, here we are talking about universal healthcare, which is something that helps everyone in the country. Everyone. There's no one that's not helped by universal healthcare. And we're also talking about AIDS, you know, in a sort of gay context. There's no gay person, however mainstream at that time, who didn't have a friend who died of AIDS, you know. And some of them, I mean, and especially actually some of the, like, rich white gay men, had, and they're, everyone they knew died of AIDS, you know, like their entire social circle. Like, people would count off, like, you know, over 100 people. Or they would take a date book and show you and be like, everyone in this date book is dead, you know. And to see, like, the whole march was organized around gays in the military, pretty much. And so, you know, instead of saying, like, what we're interested in is universal healthcare, it's like people shouldn't die because they don't have healthcare. What we're talking about is gay people should be able to go abroad and kill people and get away with it. So just that fundamental, like, hypocrisy.
Why do you think prompted that that change? Was it the fact that Clinton had enacted Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and people were responding to that immediately?
Well, I think part of it was actually not that he had enacted. Well, part of it was that, yes, but also it was just that he was elected. Period, and I think that made a lot of people completely apathetic, like immediately. Like, oh, we've arrived. You know, like, it was like, I mean, now we have Obama, and it's like, but the same thing happened with Clinton, you know, where people were like,
but it's not Bush anymore.
We don't need, yeah, it's like, we don't need to act up anymore. We don't need to be on the streets, you know, we need to be in the boardrooms, you know, we need to be making policy, you know, we need to be, he'll let us into the room. So, you know, we need to just, you know, be acting more normal and, you know, respectable and, like, aiming for his ear, you know what I mean? And also, I think the other thing, I don't know, it's hard to say. I think that the march just really marked what was already happening, you know, because people would talk about the previous march, which I think was 87 or 89, and talk about how, you know, it was actually very political.
Can you explain what you understand as assimilation?
Basically, assimilation is the sort of message, you know, the messaging of assimilation is kind of the whole, like, we're just like you mentality. So when gay people are saying, well, we are just like straight people, you know, we have no differences except for, like, who we might want to, you know, have sex with. And so the cornerstones of gay assimilation have become marriage, you know, military inclusion, adoption, ordination into the priesthood, and hate crimes legislation. So, you know, so just to break it down, you know, so marriage, people are saying, well, I mean, most of us as queers, you know, or gay people or whomever, like, we, most of us grew up in a world that basically wanted us to die or disappear. And from the way I think about it is, like, we shouldn't grow up and then think, oh, let's become part of that same world and change nothing. You know, so, and I think gays in the military is the most obvious of that, you know, so instead of saying, well, actually, you know, the U.S. is responsible for, like, more violence in the world than, you know, probably every other country combined, you know, in bombing, in terrorizing, in plundering indigenous resources, and, you know, establishing corporate control, you know, everywhere. And so instead of saying, well, we want to be part of that, we want to be part of the military, we want to be, you know, how many hundreds of bases does the U.S. have around the world? And we should be saying, we need to end the military. I mean, it's just very basic, you know what I mean? And the military as, like, a dominant institution of, like, imperial, colonial, genocidal violence, you know, around the world. And marriage, you know, most of us grew up in something, you know, or a lot, I'd say the majority of us grew up in either marriage or the ruins of marriage. And we were aware that it was kind of a mess. And so why now are we saying that's what we want? You know, and what does marriage mean? It doesn't, you know, it means, first of all, one partner, you know, it means, you know, conforming it to a sort of, like, state sanctioning of relationship, and nothing else means anything. And I mean, you know, queers have been creating, like, challenging ways outside of marriage to live with and love, you know, and take care of one another for generations. And I think, you know, what happens with the sort of assimilationist agenda is all of that is thrown in the trash. You know, that's just garbage. That's just like second, you know, what they'll say is that's second class citizenship, you know?
Do you think that this citizenship of sorts and this politics of assimilation are conditioned because there is a legal structure that is heterosexual and that defines our rights along those lines? In other words, what you're asking for is a systemic change in terms mm-hmm. of the kind of access that we have to legal structure?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think a very basic, I mean, I might ask for a lot of things, but, you know, a very basic, so if you, you know, thing, so people will say, like, the marriage thing, you know, has become very central. So people will say, well, marriage, you know, is the answer, right? So it's what's going to get us, like, you know, just fill in the blank, whether it's, like, citizenship, whether it's, you know, hospital visitation rights, whether it's, you know, immigration rights, whether it's, you know, anything. And for me, it's like, well, what are you talking about? You're talking about the rights of only people who are able or willing to conform to this institution with, like, an, you know, a history of thousands of years of, like, oppression. Whether it's, like, anti-woman, anti-queer, you know, anti-trans, anti-child violence, it all starts with marriage. You know, it's all, that's, like, the cornerstone, absolutely, right there. And so when people say, and, you know, well, guess what? I should be able to say anyone I want who wants to should be visiting me in the hospital. You know what I mean? Or should gay people who are married be the only people who are allowed to stay in this country? You know, like, or like, especially, I mean, that's the craziest one, because that's a big one that people will say, like, oh, you know, I met my partner, you know, is Brazilian, and, you know, we can't live here. You know, I mean, he can't emigrate here. And it's like, oh, well, actually, you know, have you not noticed that there are also a lot of other people who want to immigrate here, and they may not be married? The U.S. is, like, gunning people down on the borders. And so when people say marriage is going to solve fundamental issues of inequality, you know, that actually facilitates the violence continuing, you know, because marriage doesn't solve anything. You know, and sure, maybe one or two people might be, you know, or 1,000 or whatever, you know, certain people who are able and willing to conform to these very narrow things. But shouldn't we be saying, oh, actually, why do we have borders? You know what I mean? Right. Why shouldn't anyone be able to immigrate here? I think another big, big moment in its sort of like gay assimilation was Stonewall 25, you know, which, you know, was supposed to be a celebration of Stonewall, you know, a riot against police violence. But instead, you know, pretty much was just, you know, like corporate sponsorship and consumerism outweighed any kind of even marking of like a history of resistance, you know. And that was in New York in, I guess that was right after the March on Washington, pretty much. It seemed like it was like a while after. but I think, and then I think, you know, marriage, of course, became like the ultimate, you know, the ultimate like gay, you know, assimilationist agenda. Marriage has drained the resources away from everything else. I mean, there are millions and millions of dollars. There are nonprofits that have emerged just, you know, just for marriage that have, you know, like in California, the Proposition 8 ballot measure spent $40 million. Like it was the most expensive ballot measure in the history of California. And that was to lose, you know, like it was $40 million combined, you know, it was like anti-pro. But, and then what do they say whenever they lose? They just say, we need more money. So I think that's another thing that's kind of emerged is this, and this is also broader, but this sort of like, you know, structure of like gay establishment nonprofits who exist only to exist. Mm-hmm. Like they don't really do anything, you know what I mean? One thing that is very different now than say in the early 90s, I think in the early 90s was the moment, and I guess I'm grateful for having seeing this moment kind of firsthand, because I do think it was a big cornerstone moment where, because there's always been this tension in gay and queer cultures, this tension between assimilation on the one hand, or like a more liberationist, you know, or between a narrow vision of like gay identity and a broader vision, you know, of like fighting racism and militarism and, you know, homophobia all intertwined, you know, and what changed, I think, in the early 90s is that the assimilationist side became so much more powerful.
Because it became professionalized, it became a class of professional activists started to actually find positions of authority and work within established organizations? In other words, it stopped being grassroots?
I think that's part of it, but I think, but see, I think that's the thing, is that there was always that, there was always both. But I think, for example, like, let's just say the 60s, but you know, 70s, whatever. Like, you know, you could be gay and rich and still be like entirely afraid to like even say that you were gay. You know, in the 90s, we started having like David Geffen and Rosie O'Donnell and like these mega rich, you know, like gay people coming out and saying like, oh my God. And I think what happened is that the priorities of the so-called movement became their priorities. So for David Geffen, sure, maybe marriage is the last thing standing in the way of his full citizenship, you know, because that's the rhetoric of the mainstream gay movement is full citizenship, right? It's not ending, you know, the requirements of citizenship or allowing everyone to be in citizenship. It's just that gay people with money and power should be able to have all this. And so for David Geffen, like tax breaks might be a really big deal. You know what I mean? Like if gay people can, if, you know, their partners can be like, but actually that doesn't matter if you're like on the street, you've just run away from home, you lived in an abusive family, and you're trying to figure out who the hell you are. Like, to say to someone, oh, well, you could get married and you'd have healthcare. Like, what? I mean, there's just, like, the horrible violence of that. Say, every gay neighborhood started because gay people didn't have anywhere they could live and be gay. And so most of them are neighborhoods where gay people moved in the 60s, 60s and 70s, you know, some of them even earlier. And came together, created institutions, you know, opened gay bars, flower shops, you know, community spaces, you know, whatever, camera shops, you know, like whatever stereotypical. And then created this whole structure. Why is it that every single gay neighborhood, once those people gained a little more affluence, you know, gained a little more independence, which are, you know, it's great to, you know, have a little more money. It's great to have a nice house. It's great to have a neighbor you can call home. It's great to have bars where you can go and meet people and have sex. And, but why is it that all those neighborhoods always figure out a way to police the borders and to get rid of anyone who's not willing or able to conform to this very narrow notion of gay identity? So whether that be youth, whether that be people of color, whether that be trans women, whether that be sex workers, whether that be the people who lived in the neighborhood before they got there, suddenly are not part of the community, you know? And I mean, the viciousness, you know, of like gay bars arresting homeless youth because they get in the way of happy hour, you know, or, you know, gay property owners, you know, having like, you know, people doing survival sex on the streets arrested because it's going to get in the way of their property values, you know, and calling that community. I mean, that hideous violence, it just happens over and over and over. And it's, to me, I mean, it is really sad, you know, when I think about, here are these people that could have created something else, you know, like they could have, like, you know, gay people with money, you know, could, you know, who have bought an old Victorian house in the Castor, for example, renovated it. Now they have a property that's worth $2 million. And there's someone on the street who doesn't have room to sleep. Oh, could you invite them in your house and maybe have them? You could even have a separate apartment in your house with a different lock. You know what I mean? That you've never even have to go to and just have a few people sleep there every now and then, you know, or make some food for people on the street and walk around and give it to them, you know? And I mean, it's just such a vicious like cycle that is just, and I think that happens over and over again. And I think part of it is, it's this lack of vision. You know, people now, it's what is it? It's just like you grow up, you come out, and then you're done. You know, coming out should be a beginning. You know, it should be a beginning for challenging the world. It should be a beginning for figuring out a way to change things and to open more space for other people. It's not like, oh my God, I can express my sexuality. I mean,
it seems to me that the idea of a kind of queer generalized identity that would be a utopian space of community in which we would all help each other out is out of the question. And what this conversation reveals to me is that we have assimilated into what is the core of this society, which is a class and race division. So I think maybe that's the why. The why is that, you know, we are part of this society and we replicate the way that this society has shaped its politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Well, but I don't think it has to be that way, you know?
No, of course it doesn't. You know. I mean, that's why people like you are working.
Right. I mean, and I think to me, I mean, again, I think that's what a lot of my work is about, is sort of exposing that violence, you know? So when it's not okay to say something as a community, and what that really just means is that people with the most power hide behind a rainbow flag and figure out ways to oppress everyone else and get away with it, you know? And for me, and I, sometimes people will say, well, like you said, you know, like, what's your alternative? And I think the beginning of the alternative is to be able to articulate the horrible violence that's happening, you know, and to not sort of conform to, you know, this, like, you know, the sort of sweatshop produced rainbow flag vision of, like, normality, you know, and...
And also to insist that there are people that are not, that do not feel represented by that movement.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
that there are people that exist outside of those ideas of what being gay or lesbian or trans is
mm-hmm,
today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And also to create more space for people on the margins. So it's like, whatever those margins are, I mean, there's always going to be margins.
You've talked about that before, the idea of opening up more space as opposed to taking away things, but opening up more space for people to live better lives. Can you speak about that?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, I don't know, I guess, you know, when I first moved to San Francisco, you know, when I first started identifying as queer, like, it always meant, you know, it's not just queer sexually, it's like queer in every way. So, like, trying to create alternatives to, like, mainstream notions of everything, you know, whether it be, like, who you love, who you fuck, like, what you look like, you know, how you eat, you know, like, how you live. And I think, you know, like, trying to create something, not just in an escapist way, because I think there can be a lot of that, where people are like, oh, well, now I have my polyamorous, you know, land, you know, life, you know, on, you know, the land or something, you know, in a community, we live in a communal way, we share everything, blah, 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 blah. And now, which is great. I mean, that's a great beginning, but I'm not necessarily interested in the kind of escapism of, like, leaving. I want to leave and I want to be able to challenge the violence that's happening. So a lot of that is what I learned in direct action activism, you know, which has started with ACT UP and then, you know, with Fed Up Queers in New York in the late 90s, and then Gay Shame. Gay Shame, you know, emerged in New York in 1998. And originally what we wanted to do is to create a radical alternative to Pride, you know. And so instead of having an endless gated procession of corporate floats, you know, we thought, well, we'll just, you know, invite people for free, you know, into a space where people are sharing skills and strategies for resistance, you know, and where we, you know, we have bands and we have, you know, music and dancing, and then also people talking about welfare reform, you know, or talking about trans liberation, or talking about gentrification in New York, you know. And so what it started out as sort of like a once a year kind of radical alternative to Pride, where instead of buying a bunch of shit, we can make culture on our own terms and, you know, learn and share strategies for resistance. And so it went on like that for a few years in New York. And then when I moved to San Francisco, we started in San Francisco along similar lines. But then what it became after that was more of a, like, it was the same politics, but it was sort of like a direct action extravaganza, where we were committed to challenging the hypocrisy, not just of mainstream gay people, of course that was the central focus, but also of all hypocrites. And so we would throw together these very elaborate events. So, for example, one was called the Gay Shame Awards. And in the Gay Shame Awards, we rewarded the most hypocritical people, gay people, for their service to the community. So, for example, you know, we had categories like helping right-wingers cope. You know, all the things that gay people, mainstream gay people, are really good at. Exploiting our youth. We had the In Award for celebrities that should never have come out in the first place. So then we took over the main space in the Castro, the gay neighborhood in San Francisco. And then we each award was a burning rainbow flag. And what was really interesting actually about that and about a lot of gay shame actions, especially the early ones, was here what we wanted to do is create a spectacle that connects the politics with the party to such an extent that they can't be separated. Because I think in activism, and this is maybe one thing that addresses sort of a question of, like, even ACT UP. ACT UP was very spectacular, but the kind of spectacle that ACT UP engaged in now is kind of what every activist group does. And so people are like, oh, why are those people lying in the street getting arrested? Okay, boring, you know? And so we wanted to create something that was using the sort of militants of ACT UP, fusing it with sort of like the spectacle of like the Cockettes, you know, like a 70s drag troupe in San Francisco, and the focus on taking back the street of like reclaim the streets, like anti-capitalist kind of organizing. And so it was all three together was our idea. And the idea was that we would make something so spectacular, like in a sort of like ragged, you know, extravagant, like way that people would really be drawn in. And in that action in particular, the Gay Shame Awards, like there were like straight tourists who came and they're like, oh, this is really, you know, really interesting. And then we have a flyer and they're listening, and like queer youth who have nothing to do in the Castro, but they go there anyway, you know, joined it. And older queers, those three groups in particular were very excited because they have no place in the Castro, you know. I mean, straight tourists really shouldn't, but queer youth and older queers should definitely have a place in the Castro. Queer youth of color in particular. And so that was a kind of idea, and I guess part of what it's doing in a way, even if it's not in the same, you know, ACT UP was very focused on policy change. You know, it was most ACT UP actions were very specific. It was like needle exchange now, for example, you know, or even like, you know, not just an action, let's just go out and give needles, you know, or exchange needles. And Gay Shame was more about creating, is more like a vision of something, you know, in a practical terms. It was not a practical activist group. We didn't have practical actions, you know what I mean? People would say, well, what are your goals? And, you know, our goal is to challenge the violence of, you know, the assimilationist agenda and to create something in the ruins. And part of that is maybe, I mean, I may have changed my mind, but in that moment, I, you know, is about that moment. You know, is about like, here's what we have now. You know, we've taken over the street, we've created this idealized queer space. And part of that is exposing, you know, this hypocrisy that we see everywhere.
And that exposing is exposing it to the media.
Exposing it to the media, but also exposing it to itself, to you know.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about the type of work that you're doing now, the books that you edit, mm-hmm. the novels that you mm-hmm. write. It seems like the your strategy, in a sense, is to be really out vocal and out loud mm-hmm. to the media mm-hmm. and find a niche that way to a mainstream audience. Is that some of the things that you think about?
So I started writing when I was really young, you know, and writing for me, really young meaning like, you know, 6 or something, you know. I don't have any of that writing anymore, unfortunately, but writing for me was always the way that I was able to understand the world and to create a place for myself in it. And so as a kid, it was, you know, my writing was all of these, you know, it was very fantastic. You know, it was all about like creating a, you know, it was like living in a house with emerald floors and lapis lazuli ceiling, you know, and diamond walls. I didn't like diamonds, sapphire walls, you know. And but I think, you know, so it was very different, my writing then than now, which now is, you know, very realistic, presumably. But I think writing for me, you know, it still continues to be that one thing that I have that I feel like I can always access in order to understand the world, but to process it and to create my own place, you know, in it. And so, you know, in a way, that's what my novels are. You know, it's sort of like expressing the world that I see that is not, doesn't really exist, you know, out there. And it's on my terms, you know. So I write on the terms of the characters, you know, only, which is usually very similar to myself. And there's no explication, you know, like most books, you know, are like, let me tell you how I got to this terror. Let me tell you how I got here. It's like, here I am. And you either enter it or you don't, you know. And that's similar in a way to the, you know, the politics of radical activism in a certain sense. And I think my anthologies are probably the closest in a way, you know, are kind of close to direct, my direct action activism in terms of writing, in that, you know, I put out a politic, like, let's say That's Revolting. So That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. And what I wanted to do is to, well, basically, I'm looking at, you know, what's happening in the sort of gay world, you know, the assimilation that we've been talking about. And, but I also live in this other world where, you know, it's like, people are always creating radical alternatives, you know, and those are being erased. It all is erased like that, boom. Same thing with activism. I mean, I'll talk to people now, you know, they have no idea what ACT UP is. Even people my age, you know, it's exact same age, but they were not, you know, out as early, or they weren't activists. Like, and they'll make these weird jokes about ACT UP, and I'm like as if it was like something entirely different, you know, like part of the gay mainstream or something. And I'm like, well, actually, no, it was like, that's what the beginning of challenging that, you know? And so I think our memory is so quickly erased, you know? And I think...
Because it is not documented?
Yes. I think because it's not documented, and it's also not a... Well, or if it is documented, it's documented in ways that disappear, you know? And so... and it's not allowed to be in the center. It's never going to be in the center. So people will remember, like, Will and Grace. You know what I mean? Or because it's on fucking reruns on TV or something. And, but they'll have no idea. Like, they might not even know about Gay Shame, you know, which was like 10 years ago is when it started, you know, and still exists, you know, in San Francisco in some form. But we'll have no idea what it is. And so that's part of what I want to do, especially with that anthology in particular, is to document, you know, this history of like radical queer activism, but also to have this conversation amongst ourselves, where we don't have to be justifying our existence to some, like, you know, right winger or to some, like, gay assimilationist. You know, it's like same tired story. It's like we can actually talk about the things that matter, so we can talk about, like, racism in radical queer activism.
How is your work received by the official LGBT organizations? Do mm-hmm. you have does it resonate in any way, or are you turned down as somebody that it's a radical ranter and pay attention to you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, because I don't think that I ever get... I've never heard a response from someone who I would consider... Well, no, okay, I'll break it. From the... Organizationally, I don't think I've ever heard anything. Trying to think.
Because you might represent an obstacle to what they're trying to do, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually... I mean... This is my theory about that, you know, is, I mean, I think these mainstream gay organizations, especially the, you know, the sort of marriage agenda, is very comfortable with the Christian right. Like, even though that's supposedly their devout enemy, they're very comfortable because they can win any argument with the Christian right. You know, you have someone who says, you're going to burn in hell, all queers are going to burn in hell. Like, it's very easy to win that argument. You know what I mean? It's much harder to, you know, win an argument with another person who's queer, who says, well, guess what? You know, actually, marriage is not the priority I think we should have as a movement. And so I think those organizations very consciously make sure that radical queer opinions are shut out, you know, of the media, especially. You know, and whether that means gay media, straight media, you know, mainstream media, corporate media, all of it. They don't want it on, you know. And so the kinds of, that conversation is very rare. Occasionally it happens, you know, but... That's only because, you know, and of course, you know, like a radical queer opinion is very marginalized, you know, so, and there are not really people, you know, with, that have, you know, don't have $20 million to spend on a media campaign. What's interesting to me is when I articulate, like, say if I go to a university or something, well, on a few levels, university, I might have an audience where it depends on the place, you know, sometimes my audience is all queer, sometimes it's like, almost all straight, and but almost always I find that people immediately, even if they started with, they're like, oh my god, marriage is the best thing in the world, you know, And of course I support, you know, gays in the military. Like, you know, how could I not? I'm against the war and I support gays. That's my favorite. Against the war. I'm like, well, that's kind of contradictory. You can't really be against the war if you support the military, just in case. But what I notice, like in people, I think there's this idea that in order to get like mainstream people to like understand a complicated politic, that, you know, you have to like tone it down, like, or something, or like speak on their terms or something. And I don't do that at all. You know, I just speak on the terms that I believe in. And I think actually when people hear it, they actually seem to really understand quickly. At least they question. I have no idea what happens after I leave, but they seem kind of, you know, like, even I've even had like really confrontational. I mean, of course, someone who's like totally entrenched in a certain opinion, it's not going to change, you know, in that moment. But I don't know. I also find that with mainstream gay people, like, you know, middle-aged people living very normal lives, like, I'll start talking to them and they'll say, well, you know, I agree with you. I never would say it. And they don't want to say it because it's considered socially unacceptable. So they're invested. And I mean, I don't know if that's good or bad that they actually share my opinion but never say it. If that's better or worse than not, you know, thinking I'm a horrible person. Another thing that I've been really consciously trying to do for a long time is to sort of, like, because I think the real audience in a certain way for, like, a radical queer politic, like, where it's not, it doesn't exist almost at all, is in the straight left. You know, so all of the, like, institutional structures of the straight left, whether that be, you know, like, The Nation or, you know, Democracy Now or, you know, whatever, you know, like, any left media institution, like, well, it's funny, I just chose the two that are slightly, that actually have some other opinions on. But mostly, the straight left has just bought the gay mainstream agenda. And the reason is because the straight left never did their work, you know, about anything queer. They've never done anything. Now they realize, oh, it's not really cool to never talk about anything queer in my life. You know, it's supposed to. So they're like, oh, what should I do? And then they'll have the fucking HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, you know, the most right-wing, you know, gay national organization. They'll be on national, like, left programming, you know, speaking as if that's a left agenda, you know, or, like, over and over again. These marriage equality people, they're all over it. Like, some of these people fawn over them, you know, and the reason is because they've never done their work. And so I've been trying for a really long time to try to, like, infiltrate the sort of left establishment media because it is their politics. You know, it's already there. They already supposedly have this politics. They just don't get it because they've, like, sucked in this entire stupid, like, insipid, like, reactionary agenda. And unfortunately, it is because, you know, on the root, it is because of homophobia, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely where it comes from, you know. And it's also from their fear of not doing anything for 30 years, their fear as a straight person of saying, well, actually, this gay marriage movement is a crock of shit. You know, if they, like, it's much harder for them, having never done anything, because then they can be called homophobic. And even though they're not homophobic in that moment, it may be true that they're homophobic in 30 years of never covering anything gay.
Understanding the politics, having a reactionary position in relationship to the movement, wanting to infiltrate. However, are you interested in a form of social organizing that may eventually have some kind of policy effect so that it doesn't stay at the level of only at the level of infiltrating mm-hmm. by discourse, mm-hmm. but actually has a political effect of sorts. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm in no way bringing down the work that you are doing, but rather saying, mm-hmm. is there a next step for this? Mm-hmm. In the way that the gay liberation movement began. It began discursively, but then it also became a political quest that was going after the law and, mm-hmm. and so on and so mm-hmm. forth.
Well, I mean, I think unfortunately gay liberation has failed. And the reason it has failed is not because the original goals, I mean, the original goals were amazing. End of church, end of state, end of the nuclear family. Like, that hasn't happened. You know, none of that has happened. You know, end of U.S. militarism, you know, a broad agenda of, like, sexual liberation. None of it. None of that has happened. So I would say that it failed. Right. And the reason it failed for me is because it went inside. It became part of the mainstream. It became part of the institutional structures. And so for me personally, I'm not interested in becoming part of those structures in any form. I don't even want my own structure, with $20 million of my own to do what I want, because it's the same thing, And I don't want to take control or something, because I feel like I don't have an example. Maybe there is one, but I don't see one in history where the people who took control didn't do the same thing as the people before. And so I do believe, though, in building something on the margins, whatever that means. And I am interested in, I'm totally interested in, mainstream media and, infiltrating that. I am interested in creating our own media structures. I am interested in, creating radical alternatives, but not in terms of a narrow, policy legal framework.
Right.
It's not that I do think some of those legal battles are important. Like the battle against sodomy laws, for example, is very important, there are legal battles that matter, a battle for being able to determine your own gender identity. That's also important, or a battle for an end, to the prison system, those are legal battles, in a way. But I guess, maybe there are some legal battles that I'm, interested in fighting on those terms. But I think the terms have to be determined, by the people you're talking about, and I mean specifically outside of the status quo. So becoming part of, the National Gay Lesbian Task Force or something, and then changing it or something, that doesn't do anything. It's still an institution that does nothing except take people's money and speak to the center. I don't want to speak to the center. I'm fine with speaking in the center, and saying what I want if I can, in the opportunities. What being on Democracy Now! And debating Lieutenant Dan Choi, that happened because I wrote a scathing critique of her, Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, consistently having Dan Choi on and never questioning him about, this is the most famous anti-war program in the U.S. And she has this pro-war person on over and over and over again. And so that was great for me, because that's the conversation that never happens.
You sent her a letter and she responded?
Well, I actually wrote a scathing critique. Okay. I did write to her, but she didn't directly respond to that. Okay. They actually responded to the critique. Why should any left program, anytime they talk about marriage, military, hate crimes legislation, they should have someone, a queer person, who is against those things, who says, oh, hate crimes legislation, I don't want to strengthen, the same, racist, classist, homophobic, hideous, violent criminal legal system, or about marriage, the same, or about the military. And so, so I feel like I find occasionally I have, that was probably the biggest one in a way, and that caught a lot of people's attention, I've received more feedback about that interview than anything else, including entire books, that I've ever done. So in that sense, I'm totally interested in that kind of thing, in being on those programs and debating, having an actual conversation between queers about the issues that supposedly matter, to queers, instead of having, either a straight homophobe or, debating a gay person, or a gay person just talking and with no critique, that happens on the left now, I think, often. It's a cliche in a way, but people say, the margins determine the center, you know? But it's true, And so I think if there are no margins, then the center will never change. So I guess the question is, how do you create the space and not become part of that same, structure, like the gay establishment has become.